This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. No one is shocked when a paper mill closes anymore. The shocking thing is when one reopens. Now, that's a quote that's made in a recent New York Times article on the surprising reopening of a closed paper mill up in Wisconsin. It's the latest involvement in what seems to be a long-running narrative about the state of recycling markets in the country, prompted by an announcement made in China. And we had a chance to talk with Neil Samahan, the CEO of Metro Recycling, about it. How do we find ourselves in Northwest Indiana with the recycling markets these days compared to the word that first came out from China that they weren't going to take hardly anything at all from us? Maybe we should, I guess, go back in history a little bit and explain why China made the announcement they did that seems to have had such a great impact on the scrap markets all across our country, but in particular for Northwest Indiana.
Well, first, I guess I'd answer the first part of your question, how do we find ourselves? And I would say challenged. Why do we find ourselves challenged? If we turn back the clocks to 2017, mid-2017, China announced that by the end of the year of 2017 going into 2018, that they were banning quite a large amount of recyclables, importation of, which the United States exports quite a bit of, back then, quite a bit of its recyclables to China. About 25% of the recyclable material is exported. Of that 25%, almost 40% of that would go to China. So it was a pretty significant amount. So their initial reasoning was to get a better control on things that were going on in their environment. You know, if we look back at even their Olympics and we hear stories of things they did to curtail industrial production to cut down on the amount of pollution, that, amongst other things, you know, essentially was a wake-up call, and they were looking to address their environment and thought that one area that they would take a look at was the importation of what they were claiming was low-grade recyclable material, which, in fact, you know, was the case, but that was by their choice. But their claim was that a bunch of the material that was coming over was contaminated as well. So they started putting restrictions in place, and that has actually increased since. And effectively, by putting a middle of the year, by saying that, you know, end of the year, January 1st, 2018, we're no longer going to import your recyclables. Effectively, that was almost immediately, right? Because by the time you collect it, put on a container, send it over to China, that takes months to begin with. So it was a hard stop here in the United States, which had a scurrying for markets, if there were any, to take up the additional material that could not go to China.
Now, I know, Neil, that we initially were talking about, I guess, primarily scrap paper. This is all kinds of different mixes of types of paper together that would go over as a mix, as opposed to being just like all newspapers or all cardboard boxes or something of the like, or good high-grade paper all together in one spot. But has this gone further beyond just the scrap paper market that China is rejecting? Are they also banning other types of recyclables too?
Yes, essentially started with paper. Effectively, they are no longer taking any plastics. It's also affected the metals markets, where, you know, they're going to stop, or actually at the end of last year, they banned what they call Category 7 copper scrap, which is some low-grade scrap items. And then later on this year, they're going to restrict their intake of another category of copper, which is even a little bit higher grade than the grade 7. So it's going for both metals and paper, plastic, you know, so on and so forth, making it, yeah, quite challenging. And then with one of the first steps that China took in retaliation to, you know, some of the trade sanctions that the U.S. put in place, they put a 25% tariff on scrap aluminum virtually immediately, which kind of, I think, does underscore the significance of the scrap market and recycling market to trade and with China.
It's amazing. I guess that we didn't, until all this happened, we had no idea, I suppose, or the average person certainly didn't have any idea how important all these overseas markets are to being able to handle our recyclables, that we either haven't been able to set up the mechanism here in the States, or never, I guess, really thought about doing so, to be able to process all of this stuff within our own continent, much less have to send it overseas.
Yeah, I don't think anybody that you know puts the recyclables in the container, you know, thinks twice about it. Thinks it goes to their local waste hauler, which then they separate and then sell without issue. It's recyclable. We're told it's recyclable. Something I say, you know, time and time again. I might even said it last time we spoke.
Probably
is that what makes something recyclable is essentially if there's a market for it, regardless of if it has, you know, a number and an arrow around it. Unless there's a market for that item, it is not recyclable. And we have found that out, or some areas of the country have found that out as they've accumulated some of this material. And there is no market for it. Essentially, they were forced to put some of it into landfills, where essentially it is something that is technically, you know, has the ability to be recycled. But there was no market for it, and they just were accumulating it so fast that they had no other choice. I think ultimately some of this is going to play itself out, and markets will correct and come in balance. But the initial impact is that some of the material in some places, not in Northwest Indiana, but in some places, you know, could potentially or has potentially gone to landfills.
Have you found, in talking with your colleagues and from the publications and information that you get, that I'm sure that a lot of these problems have kind of shifted over to the West Coast because that's where all the ports are that were headed to China, with materials going to China. Have they been able to find other markets, maybe off, not necessarily in China, but perhaps in the Far East and other places in that direction, to be able to market some of the material that China refused to take in?
Yes. There have been some other markets that have jumped in, some other market participants. India has probably seen the largest growth of exports. However, with that being said, as they're looking at their future and they're looking at what was being imported by China, their concern is as they're developing their processes and consumption of this material is they want to be careful not to essentially import the rest of the world's garbage as well. Mm-hmm. Some of the things that motivated China to change the type of material they're taking in, other countries, you know, don't want to fall in that same trap, which is going to cause, you know, which, look, I think there's going to be some opportunities going forward, but it's going to take time. Where different type of facilities, maybe even better facilities here in the United States or elsewhere, will, you know, will come into play that can consume the material, or better technologies here stateside or anywhere that's exporting the, you know, the recyclables, and give them the ability to recover more of the, you know, let's call it valuable aspects of what may be in the recycling stream. Because ultimately, some of this is also going to fall upon us as, you know, consumers, homeowners, to really follow the guidelines of what local municipalities or your local waste haulers are asking to curtail in terms of what's being put into their blue bins. We can't put in our containers what we wish or believe should be recycled. We've got to follow the guidelines of what we're being told should go in there, which would then ultimately make the stream of material that the waste haulers are needing to contend with a cleaner product, where they can either reach the new standards that are going to be imposed upon some of these overseas consumers, or, you know, give a better ability here even in the States to consume the product. When we throw contaminants in our recyclables, it does have a damaging effect on the product that's being made. Because ultimately, you know, even though you believe you're discarding a recyclable, ultimately it's a product that is being sold by someone.
We know that there have been companies that have taken on the extra load, I'm sure. For example, within in the scrap paper industry, we have companies like Pratt Industries. They have their facilities in Porter County and elsewhere where they're able to take in a certain amount of paper material and turn it into something good. You're still finding, I'm sure, that some markets off perhaps over in Illinois, maybe other places that you send some of your scrap metals to are taking in some of these things that China seems to be rejecting. We're still finding, though, I imagine that it still comes down, and you've mentioned it a little bit here in our conversation about the fact that we have to pay more attention about what we put into our recycling bins or sends out to the truck and the carts that we put out along curbside as well to be sure that this is all good, clean material. And we're talking not only physically clean, but looks like scrap material clean too.
Yeah, ultimately, right, is again, follow the guidelines of, what your local waste hauler is asking. I think that's a key thing that will assist. If you're concerned with what's happening, that would be a big plus to assist the process. There are companies such as Pratt. On one hand, I would say that they, to a degree, have benefit from this process, because of the type of facility they have and the type of product they have consumed with being low-grade paper. The mixed paper value has dropped considerably to virtually nothing. And they were positioned, to take advantage of this, so to speak, because that's one of their biggest input products. It has created challenges for others, but they've certainly, benefited to an extent. But then there's still the cost of getting them that material to their facilities and still encouraging people to send it to them, even though there is little or no value.
Now, are you folks at Metro Recycling and Metro Auto Recyclers finding more of a challenge here now that you've gotten this word out that certain grades of, say, copper, which, of course, you're going to find in prominence in things like radiators and the like and vehicles and other scrap copper as well, too, if you're finding the low market value out there for that, you'd have to kind of rearrange what you are all doing?
Well, a lot of it comes down to potentially how we would price the commodities. That's probably the biggest challenge. You want to be able to offer a price where it still encourages and promotes recycling.
Mm-hmm.
And still allow us the ability to do that. So a lot of it has to do with pricing. But ultimately, there are markets for most everything that we're collecting. The challenge is on the value side, can we price it enough to encourage it? Can we, make enough margin? The difficulty in a commodity business is, especially this type of commodity, is it's wildly fluctuating, and values, can be, well, if you take a look at, scrap aluminum last year, dropped by 25% almost immediately from when China announced that they were their retaliation. The fact of the matter is, to pay for insurance for our employees, wages, that all goes up regardless of if a commodity drops by 25% or over the course of time. Last year, a couple of commodities dropped by 60% or more, or in terms of paper, even higher than that.
Yeah.
Where ultimately, we don't, in essence, have pricing power, right? I can't raise the price of milk or bread, based on external, circumstances. I can only reduce my prices so much if that's what I need to do, to create, the ability to have all these expenses. But the challenge is ultimately it's got to be priced at an area enough to, again, encourage recycling. Because the unfortunate reality is, to some extent, people are driven to recycle by value, its value is, especially on our side of the market. It's a little different on your curbside, you're throwing in the bin, but sometimes on the metal, it really has to do with what is that ultimate value. People want to recycle, and they should, and it's up to us within the industry to determine, whether it's new technologies, new processes, new markets. We're exploring, whether it's a company or a trade organization is exploring, where are new markets available. And even looking at potentially, there's some Chinese companies that are looking within the United States to potentially process some material to ultimately make a cleaner product here stateside that then can go to China.
Got this balance of being able to take what you take in to help those people recycle, but then too, you've got to be sure that the margin is there, that you can pay the cost of shipping it out to whatever market it goes to, and take care of business, basically taking care of employees and all of your expenses in doing all that work. So I can see it's a tough business to be in, and I guess we have to look admiringly at companies like Metro Recycling to try and get it all done and to try and balance things out. So we have to take our hats off to you folks for working so hard to help keep us recycling and help be able to pay the bills as well too.
Well, thanks. And ultimately, these materials, even if they're currently is some difficulties in marketing the material, and I'll kind of look back more at the curbside, you know, side of the situation. Even though there's current obstacles, ultimately it's important for us as a whole to try to find, you know, markets and uses for, right? One of the biggest drivers that would increase the value of some of these items, better off in reducing our consumption, to create less, you know, items that we find ourselves needing to recycle, but ultimately then find more products that are made of recycled material, which will increase the value and increase its marketability, its ability to be used. And the more areas that we find to do that, ultimately will, you know, absorb some of the challenges, I guess, in finding markets for it.
Still important, number one, to keep it clean, make sure there are no contaminants or what you can recognize as contaminants in it, and in turn making sure that it's able to be reused again. That probably is just a couple of things we have to keep in mind too, I suppose.
That's correct, yeah.
Well, Neil Temenhan, thank you very much for spending some time with us explaining things. So,
sure. No, I thank you, Chris. And I will say, though, that the future does look bright. Even though there's challenges, I think always when there's challenges, there's opportunities. And an industry as a whole, or our industry as a whole, are looking for those opportunities, which ultimately we'll all benefit from going forward. It's just a bump in the road.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. Well, once again, the Multi-Agency Academic Cooperative, better known as MAC, is busy training people here in Northwest Indiana, and the latest trainees are 13 firefighters that represent a number of fire departments here in Northwest Indiana. And to tell us about this latest graduating class, we have from the MAC Foundation, Selena Weatherwax. Selena, thanks for joining us today.
I appreciate the opportunity to highlight some of these courageous men and women for us. Thank you.
We know that that MAC's been busy for a long time here in Northwest Indiana, in particular with the operation that's been set up in Valparaiso, in training people to handle tasks that are important in public safety here in the region, and in particular helping train firefighters do a better job when they go back home to their departments. So tell us a little bit about what the Fire Training Academy is all about, the program that runs for 9 weeks that these latest graduates have come from.
Well, the nine-week program is a very rigorous, intense program. Most of these individuals that went through the academy were sponsored by a department. So majority of them came from East Chicago. We had a cadet come through from Hammond, another from Gary, and another from Hannah Township. So the group itself is made up of a number of departments from throughout the region, and they report to the MAC Monday through Friday, and they do this for 9 consecutive weeks. And upon graduation, then they return to their home department where their training continues. Mm-hmm. So this is just the first leg, essentially the basics of firefighting that are taught, and then they continue to go on and become experts in the field at their home station.
Yeah, I was wondering what they get if they just, it's kind of like basic training for them, I guess, is kind of with a comparison with the military. And once they, in this case, I guess, once they get out of boot camp, in this case, firefighting boot camp, then they go back, I guess, for specialized training at their home departments. Is it a case where they basically, everybody can learn the basics of firefighting, and then when they go back, they learn more about their specific communities?
That's correct. And then they continue to come to the MAC throughout, you know, the rest of their careers is our hope, and continue to grow and develop professionally. But in addition to these cadets that graduated on Friday, we also have a large cohort going through right now of volunteer firefighters. Mm-hmm. That's about class of 35, 36 individuals there. And we also have a high school program. So we're essentially, teaching men and women of all ages how to respond in the event of an emergency.
Now, how is the setup there at the MAC Academy in Valparaiso when you have all of these classes and firefighting training going on at the same time or in different parts of the facility?
Oh, that's a great question. But we designed the facility to host 5 to 6 departments at any given time.
Yeah.
And we've also seen an increase on the law enforcement end. And so we have both, you know, police officers as well as firefighters training alongside one another, which is something that is very unique. But like I said, we can host 5 or 6 departments at any given time without there being any overlap whatsoever.
Now, let me ask, in some communities, in large communities in particular, sometimes firefighters go out on a call and they have to be accompanied by police officers that go out there as protection in a way, especially if they're in a rough neighborhood. Do they get that same kind of training or something similar to it between both the police departments and the fire departments?
We will explore that a bit more here in the near future, but right now what's happening is there's more coordination, more communication taking place, unlike what we've seen before. Most times they respond on scene together, yet seldom do they know each other.
Right.
As a result of having the centralized training site, there's more dialogue that's taking place between agencies, which is something very unique. But yes, to your point, the idea is for them to be able to also train together.
We're talking with Selena Weatherwax, who is with the MAC Foundation, which stands for Multi-Agency Academic Cooperative. It's based in Valparaiso. It's basically a very, very large training facility. In this case, not only law enforcement, but firefighters. And this time we're finding out more about the latest graduating class of firefighters. And these are professional firefighters, we should say. These are people that work full-time for a department. What are the differences, if any, that the training between the full-time firefighters and the volunteer firefighters get?
That's a great question, and the answer is none. The curriculum is the same on both sides. It's just a matter of how long it takes for them to complete the curriculum. So for a volunteer, they meet Tuesdays and Thursday nights and all day Saturdays out of the MAC. A career firefighter meets Monday through Friday. And so that's how they're able to complete it within the 9 weeks. A volunteer typically takes about 6 months to complete the curriculum. But again, it's the same, as well as the same for the high school students.
Now, we have these classes that are underway right now, more graduates to come out, not only the volunteer firefighters, as you say, that are underway right now. Any more full-time firefighter training courses coming up?
We're having discussions now about lining up the next class. It's just a matter of need of local departments, how many hires they are making. And how many people they need to put through.
Like, for example, you've had East Chicago this time around, and a lot of graduates coming out of that the fire department. Maybe it might be Hammond, or it might be Merrillville, or maybe some other department, huh?
Exactly. It's just a matter of what their hiring needs are. So, for example, East Chicago graduated 8 firefighters. Serena has been a strong proponent and supporter of the MAC. But he also shared with me just on Friday that, next class he's looking at maybe hiring 2 or 3. So the numbers change throughout the year.
Well, that's interesting. And let me just ask the question, if anybody, and we're talking here departments, whether it's full-time fire departments or it's volunteer fire departments, if they're not already aware of how to reach you folks at the Fire Training Academy, how can they do so?
They could visit our website at www.MAAC Foundation.com, and our phone number also is a way to reach us by calling 219-510-9111.
Selena Weatherwax is the president of the McMillan Family Foundation, which is heard also operates the MAC Foundation, which has its law enforcement and its firefighting training center located in Valparaiso. As Northwest Indiana, and all of Indiana for that matter, deals with the opioid addiction epidemic that we are facing, there are organizations out there creating resource centers to help Hoosiers who are struggling with substance abuse disorder for themselves as well as for their loved ones. One of them is called the Addiction Policy Forum. And we have with us one of the key people involved in this project. Justin Phillips is the founder and the executive director of an organization in Indianapolis called Overdose Lifeline Incorporated, and she's joining us from the capital city. Justin, thanks for joining us here on Regionally Speaking.
Thank you for having me.
Well, if you will explain first what the organization that you founded, of which you're the executive director, Overdose Lifeline, is all about.
In my previous life, I was working to address unintentional injuries and deaths that were primarily due to motor vehicle crashes, falls, fire and burn. And so I understood public health and policy and grassroots advocacy around preventable death, but I did not expect to have a life experience of losing my son to a heroin overdose. So his name was Aaron, and he passed away in October of 2013. And at that time, Indianapolis Metropolitan Police were just beginning to look at using the overdose reversal drug naloxone. Mm-hmm. So the law had just passed for first responders. And I like to call it sometimes the imperfect storm that I have this professional skill set and this very difficult life experience, and I was exposed to a need that existed, which was to help first responders have access to the overdose reversal drug and also to address all the other gaps in understanding, knowledge, and prevention around opioid misuse. So that's what we do.
It's a very, very simple mode of a way to get to help to people that need the help the most, certainly. What have you found in the years since you founded the nonprofit about trying to deal in particular with such a serious crisis as not only the opioid epidemic, but also just, I guess, for that matter, the stigma of addiction itself?
Right. That's like really the key piece is the stigma that exists and the shame that individuals who are suffering from opioid use disorder have. The judgment we have on society around this particular chronic disease, the way that we treat it, completely different than other chronic diseases, and the complete lack of understanding that we all had, including myself, that prescription for a legitimate reason, like hydrocodone, is in fact heroin in a different form.
Right. Yeah. We understand that the Addiction Policy Forum is really a nationwide organization, of which I know that you're the Indiana State Chapter co-chair. How did you get involved directly with the APF, as it's called? Is it certainly from the work that you have done every single day, working for the Overdose Lifeline?
You know, I would hope that because we have this active role in our state, that they considered us already a leader, and mm-hmm. we did get an introduction to them early on a few months ago when they were beginning their work. So they did come to us and ask, you know, myself and Overdose Lifeline to serve as state co-chair.
In putting things together for the presentation to be able to get this word out about the creation of the Indiana chapter, what statistics can you share with us here about the problem as it happened the last information you have from 2016, and how many people in Indiana seem to be affected by the epidemic?
It's so challenging to know completely, but I would venture to guess when we consider that whole 6 degrees of separation mm-hmm. concept, that every single person knows someone. That every single person is affected within that 6 degrees of separation.
Now, in your experience with the overdoses in the handling the cases that you have handled here, we know, of course, there are different types of overdoses. In particular, we have, of course, the serious narcotics. We more or less associate with overdose problems like heroin and other things, cocaine as well. But where does the opioids seem to fit into this now that everything seems to be changing? At the emphasis now seems to be moving a little away from those older narcotics, so to speak, and with this new one, the opioids.
We know that, so they're all opioids, right? And we also know that 4 out of 5 people start with a prescription and move to heroin. And often individuals are moving to heroin because they found themselves addicted to their opioid prescription and no longer able to acquire it. So we, for one cause, is that we overprescribed. We made pain a vital sign and we overprescribed. At the last statistic I heard from the CDC director was, We had enough medication for every single American citizen to be medicated every day for 3 weeks.
Good grief.
So we had too many prescriptions. And then, say, I myself found myself dependent on my prescription, but my doctor won't give it to me anymore because he's caught on to me misusing. And so I turn to the street because I'm unwilling to suffer through the withdrawal, and I don't have any resources to help me with the withdrawal, which is typical. So I go to the street, and you'd be surprised who's buying drugs off the street, okay? And you'd be surprised who's selling drugs. We have elderly patients prescribed narcotics who are selling their prescriptions for money. But anyway, you know, on the street, a prescription pill is $80, but the drug dealer says to you, hey, I have this similar thing you've been using, and they don't tell you it's heroin, and you get it, and they say, just snort it, and you snort it, and now you're doing heroin, and now you're hooked on heroin.
No. The Addiction Policy Forum has created an addiction resource center that is helping Hoosiers dealing with this problem of substance abuse disorder. If you will, take us through the process, starting with the toll-free number that's available for people, family members, or addicts, people realizing that they're addicted to the drugs, that they can call, and what procedure do they go through? What help will they get on the other end of the line?
So you can use their toll-free number Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And when you call that number, you will be connected to an individual who is trained in addiction navigation. So it may be a clinical person. It may be a person trained in peer recovery processes. But that live person will help you navigate what type of treatment you may need, what type of treatment you may be looking for, what your insurance coverage is, who's taking insurance, who's not, do you need inpatient, do you need outpatient, you know, all the various facets of what somebody might need. That person on the other end of the phone is going to be able to provide help with you to answer those questions.
We're talking,
and
with...
they're going to know the questions you need to ask, right? Because some families and caregivers don't even know what to ask.
We're talking with Justin Phillips, who is the creator and executive director of an organization in Indianapolis called Overdose Lifeline, which is a nonprofit that helps serve the state of Indiana and is dedicated to preventing opioid deaths and reducing the stigma of addiction. And we're talking about her being the co-chair of the Indiana State chapter of what is called the Addiction Policy Forum. We've talked a little bit here about this toll-free number that people can call to reach the Addiction Resource Center. And we know so many people are connected or interconnected by the Internet these days. Is there an online resource center that if people go online, they can take advantage of, too, in the same way as making the phone call?
The Addiction Resource Center is an online portal that you can actually use if you are concerned about yourself or you're concerned about someone else. So you would make that choice when you're on the portal. And then again, you can choose, you can take an assessment, or if you already know and you don't need to take an assessment, you can do what they call build your own action plan. And you can choose all these fields and do all these filters. So it will then provide to you the resources within your community that are available to you at this time.
Now, we know that the Addiction Policy Forum and the Addiction Resource Center that it's created here in Indiana is relatively new, but have you had a chance to find out from the folks working at the center, are there any success stories yet that somebody has called the hotline or they've reached it online to find out more information to get the help they needed and been able to save somebody's life?
I think it's too new for us to have any of those anecdotal stories back yet. I apologize.
Yeah. Well, that's what we learned about these things, and that's why I guess over time you get the information in. It's sad enough that the opioid addiction epidemic has gone on as long as it had. Is there anything, one thing in particular, as we conclude our conversation here, that you would like to pass along to our listeners about the advantages of this particular service, that why it's so important to go online or to make the phone call?
I think it's important for families especially to know that there is someone out there who can help them with the overwhelming misunderstanding and questions and concerns that they have. It's a very lonely place to be when you have somebody that you love suffering from substance use disorder, and the shame and stigma interfere with your really willingness to want to talk to the people closest to you, you know, coworkers. I would say we never bring casseroles to people who have substance use disorder, but we always bring casseroles to people who, you know, have someone in their family suffering from cancer.
We're talking with Justin Phillips, who is the wife and mother of three children, and sad to say one of their sons passed away from a heroin overdose in 2014, and that's led to her involvement as the founder and the executive director of an organization in Indianapolis called Overdose Lifeline. And she is also now the co-chair for the Indiana chapter, the Addiction Policy Forum. And they have just created an addiction resource center to help people that are suffering and family members, too, that are suffering as well through the opioid epidemic. And Justin, thank you very much for being with us to tell us, unfortunately, the sad story that you face personally, but the way that you're able to help other people get out of the problems that they are in.
Well, thank you for the opportunity to share the resource and to help eliminate the need that individual families and caregivers have.
A lack of childcare has become an issue in many Indiana cities, not just because parents have to take days off to watch their kids, but also because that loss of worker productivity hurts municipalities hoping to grow. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Samantha Horton reports from Crawfordsville.
Inside Wabash College English professor Agata Stashek Brewer's office, markers and crayons are scattered on the floor, along with paper covered in a child's artwork.
Just today, when I was waiting for you to arrive to record the interview, I had both kids with me at the office.
Her 20-month-old daughter was sick and unable to go to childcare for today. But for her 9-year-old son, it's spring break, and Stashek Brewer was unable to find a place that would watch him for the week.
So he spent the entire week with me at the office, going with me from meeting to meeting, going to the classroom when I was teaching. And so that certainly wasn't optimal for him or for me.
Stashek Brewer had to cancel student meetings and dedicate work time to watching her children. A recent report from the Indiana Business Review says it's a common problem. The study examines the ratio of children to child care providers throughout Indiana and finds Montgomery County is one of many struggling to meet demand. Crawfordsville faces a tough challenge, with national unemployment at 3.8%, and Indiana's even lower. It's competing with other communities to attract workers. But for workers who choose the city, it has to have amenities they need, such as available daycare. Perry County officials and businesses collaborated by bringing groups together to form a community child care center. With a population of about 16,000, Crawfordsville Mayor Todd Barton says large corporations only locate smaller branches in Crawfordsville, meaning it's less likely those operations will offer their own child care to employees. So he's assembled what he calls a child care initiatives team to look at possible ways to address the shortage. He's trying to bring businesses together, but has looked at other solutions, including encouraging unlicensed child care providers to consider licensure.
Many of them are not licensed. Maybe they're apprehensive about that process. We want to, you know, just make sure that they understand it's not a scary process and that we are here to help guide them and bring them along if they so choose.
Okay, who's ready for crackers?
Cookies! There you go, sis.
Trinity Carr serves peanut butter and crackers with milk to the children at her in-home business, Precious Lambs Daycare.
Are you done with your bottle?
Before becoming a licensed provider, Carr watched just a handful of children at a time, which is legal in Indiana, so long as no more than 5 unrelated kids are being cared for at once. Eventually, she decided to grow, which meant seeking a license, a move she believes made people more comfortable coming to her.
I felt that with being licensed, parents would be more lenient towards a licensed in-home because they know that with license comes with rules and regulations that I would have to follow.
Having a license has also given her the ability to get food reimbursement and take vouchers from parents. But like many daycares, a lot of her business has come through word of mouth, and that's led to a common problem, creation of a waiting list that can go months between available spots. Carr says Crawfordsville must have childcare, so she supports others opening up their homes as either licensed or unlicensed providers. But state officials say getting a license can take 6 months to a year from the time of application. Agatesh Deshak Brewer is still on the wait list for a licensed center to get her daughter into, but has been able to find a temporary spot at an unlicensed facility. And while she likes the teachers, she has concerns.
There are some structural problems and overcrowding, but that is our only option. So beggars can't be choosers.
She says she loves her job and has no plans to leave Crawfordsville. But if she does, she says childcare availability will be her number one priority. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Samantha Horton.
This is National Poetry Month.
I'm Robert Polito, president of the Poetry Foundation, and this is Poetry Now. Today, Robert Fernandez reads a new poem called And. Titled after our most common conjunction, And arises from some surprising circumstances, including composer Franz Schubert, poet Jack Spicer, and inevitably our own mortality.
And. Give us water and food to pursue our tasks. Help us not become wards of the state, impoverished, homeless, destitute, crushed under the heel, buried in systems, imprisoned, dead, hospitalized. We die, die, die. There's a poet named Jack Spicer who died when he was 40. San Francisco poet, mid-century. And his work takes the figure of Orpheus as a kind of premise for what the poet does. So the poet enters language as a kind of Orpheus going into hell. We die, die, die. And Spicer always had the kind of, you know, taint of mortality, the whiff of death about his work. Our apartments will not pack themselves after we die. But I think that poets have a bad track record in terms of staying alive. And if they're not aware of their mortality, if they're not acutely concerned with mortality, they should be. And give us water and food to pursue our tasks. Help us not become wards of the state, impoverished, homeless, destitute, crushed under the heel, buried in systems, imprisoned, dead, hospitalized. We die, die, die. Our dogs will not walk themselves after we go. Our bodies will not burn themselves after we go. Our apartments will not pack themselves after we die. Instead, bright ribbons of work tangled in our bodies will be vomited out, and indeed, bright ribbons will be vomited out. In the meantime, the light's eyelashes open and close. And in the meantime, work and reprieve. Lie down. Don't lie. Lie flat. Lie still. See these books bound in itching white leather? They are your life. And each feathery page lifted by hot wind. O summer air, O gardens, O seasons, O chateau, the glaring day it binds, O occurrence, O soil, O soul. It's a poem that I think feels the weight and the heaviness of things, of the world, and the embarrassment of our interdependence that's nonetheless absolutely, you know, a fact of existence and that's absolutely necessary. Our bodies will not burn themselves after we go. Our apartments will not pack themselves after we die. And so those ribbons of work, those are things that need to be done in order to, you know, tidy up a body and, you know, tidy up the remains of a life. Bright ribbons of work tangled in our bodies will be vomited out, and indeed, bright ribbons will be vomited out. What I like about Schubert is that he was relatively unknown while he was alive. He was known to a close circle of friends, and yet he produced this amazing work. And it's touching to me that without the efforts of a core group of friends, that work may not have survived. And indeed, bright ribbons will be vomited out. And it's a sort of staggering, you know, realization that this work hangs, like our bodies do in the poem, so precariously in the balance. See these books bound in itching white leather? They are your life. The supports that we trust and that we take for granted can be removed so quickly. But there is something in the feathery page lifted by hot wind that holds out a kind of promise for preservation.
That was Robert Fernandez with his new poem, And. To learn more about poetry now, please visit our website, poetryfoundation.org. For Poetry Now, I'm Robert Polito. This is the WFMT Radio Network, Chicago.
The Northwest Indiana Symphony Orchestra, led by musical director and a conductor, Kirk Muspratt, is making available The Keys to France this coming Friday, beginning at 7:30 at the auditorium at Living Hope Church in Merrillville. Kirk Muspratt stopped by the Lakeshore Public Radio studios recently to talk about the very French concert, the featured artist, and the pieces that will be played.
This is a very exciting concert, I think. First of all, Winston Choi, who is the head of the piano department at Roosevelt downtown in Chicago, has played with us before. He's an award-winning, prize-winning pianist who can play anything and one of the most highly regarded and sought-after pianists in the entire region, not just Chicago, but he's playing all over the world. So he's going to play the brilliant Saint-Saëns Piano Concerto No. 2. We're going to also play the Saint-Saëns Organ Symphony. It's so-called the Organ Symphony because in the final movement, the huge, enormous organ comes in on top of the orchestra. And I maybe shouldn't use the word obliterates. That's not a very good artistic word, is it?
Well, that's probably being accurate. You know, it overpowers everybody.
Yeah, it's really overpowering. And we have John Scherer, who is the principal organist down at 4th Presbyterian in Chicago, coming to play with us. And I've done this piece with another orchestra with him, and it is really hair-raising. In the middle of the program, we're going to play Bolero, which people have asked me for so many times. I just had somebody the other day, I ran into them at the gas station, and I said, how you doing? And he goes, yeah, conductor, how you doing? And he said, are you ever going to play Beethoven 5? And I told him when we might do that.
Yeah.
And it's Beethoven's 250th birthday next year. And he said, when are you going to play that Bolero piece? And so I open my trunk, and I say, here's a brochure. We're playing Bolero on April the 5th. So, and we just hired two, there's so many solos in the piece. We just hired two amazing saxophone players to play the two sax solos in it.
Now, we know that concert is entitled The Keys to France. What is the link between France and Ravel's Bolero?
Well, Ravel's French. Does that make
sense? Of course.
Yeah.
Of course, that would make perfect
but
sense.
But yes. Ravel also was very invested where he grew up in France, and his upbringing and also his heritage at some point was very interested in the Pyrenees and all of Spanish music.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, at the time he lived, there was a huge fascination with everything Hispanic at the beginning of the 20th century in France.
I guess that's why I asked the question, because people more associate that music, Bolero in particular, with the Spanish music, the way it sounds. And you don't think about the fact that the man who wrote it is really French, but he's obviously French Pyrenees.
I can't remember right now if tell me, but his mother or grandmother was Spanish, I believe, and he spent time in Spain. And everybody, it's sort of like one of those fascinations where, I don't know, the whole world goes crazy for Art Deco, or the whole world goes crazy for Impressionism, or the whole world goes crazy for, you know, for instance, in Italy at one point, everything that was from Asia was just an unbelievable fascination. So at this point in music history, everybody was nuts about Hispanic stuff.
Well, it makes perfect sense, to be sure. Now, also, too, we should mention that the Keys to France, which is coming up on April 5th, will be performed in the auditorium at the Living Hope Church. And tell us where Living Hope Church is for people that aren't familiar where it is.
It's almost in Crown Point. And it's in Merrillville.
Good way to describe it. Now, if anybody's interested, they'd like to have tickets for any of the concerts. There may still be some available, I'm sure. How could you get them?
Well, just call the office. I'm just looking at the exact address of Living Hope. It's 9000 Taft Street.
Oh, and yes. It's
just north of 93rd Avenue,
yeah.
If that makes sense.
Oh.
You call 836-0525.
That's Kirk Muspratt with the Northwest Indiana Symphony Orchestra talking about Friday's concert. And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you for joining us. Tomorrow on Reporters Roundtable Thursday, we will have with us to talk about the stories that they've had online and in print from the Post Tribune. Meredith Coleus-Pete will join us, as well as from the Times, Giles Bruce and Joseph Pete. Hope you can join us.